Chapter 4. Fighting the Good Fight. You people really disgust me. Freedom of religion, or is it that not in our Constitution? I am not a zealot, but people like you make me want to throw up. You guys and the ACLU are the ones destroying the moral fabric of this country, and the holes are showing. After your deaths, we will see who was right. I bet it will be hot where you guys will end up. An email to American atheists. They knew that to put God in the Constitution was to put man out. They knew that the recognition of a deity would be seized upon by fanatics and zealots as a pretext for destroying the liberty of thought. They knew the terrible history of the Church too well to place in her keeping or in the keeping of her God the sacred rights of man. They intended that all should have the right to worship or not to worship, that our laws should make no distinction on account of creed. They intended to found and frame a government for man and for man alone. They wished to preserve the individuality of all, to prevent the few from governing the many and the many from persecuting and destroying the few. Robert Greene Ingersoll. I'm sick of being told not to be a dick, and not just because I dislike gender-specific insults, which I only use in this case because it's what some people call me. It's sometimes important to do things that make people call you a dick. I'm going to spend some time talking about why acting in a manner that some people regard as dickish is not only appropriate, but also necessary to the movement and the country and, in an important way, downright nice. So, what's a dick? The definition varies from person to person, but to many, I'm a dick whenever I say something that makes theists angry or even mildly puts them out. If I call religion a myth, I'm a dick. What I say might be true, but I'm still a dick. If I say theists are brainwashed from an early age to believe a myth or to pretend to believe if they don't, I'm a dick. What I'm saying is true, but I'm a dick for saying it. I am accused of saying things that incite hate and anger, but it is not as if I begin my sentences with, "Yesterday when I was skull-fucking your savior." I simply tell the truth and use labels that are accurate, if not politically correct. The people who get angry at me when hearing the truth do so because the truth hurts. Just for example, look at the multiple hadith, sayings of the Prophet, which many Muslims regard as holy scripture, that state that Muhammad married a little girl. Quote, Aisha reported, "Allah's apostle married me when I was 6 years old, and I was admitted to his house when I was 9 years old," end quote. That Muhammad consummated his marriage with Aisha when she was 9, quote, "The Prophet wrote the marriage contract with Aisha while she was 6 years old and consummated his marriage with her while she was 9 years old, and she remained with him for 9 years," end quote, is important because it calls into question the so-called perfect morality of Muhammad. It also calls direct attention to the plight many young girls continue to face because Muhammad's rape of Aisha is cited in certain parts of the Muslim world as sufficient justification today for little girls to be married off and raped. See how I just used the word rape there to talk about sex between an old man and a little girl? That's me being a dick again by telling the truth. In the U.S. justice system, such horrible behavior would justifiably lead to long prison sentences, and in prison, such a rapist would be low on the social totem pole, below murderers. Nobody whose morality is perfect can hurt a child, at least in the opinion of most good people, and this means Muslims need to deal with this fact about their prophet. If I say, Muhammad raped 50 children, most followers of Islam would laugh because it's not a true statement. But if I mention the rape of Aisha, those same Muslims get angry because it's true, according to their own texts. Truth hurts, and they must deal with truth, unless nobody mentions any of this for fear of being labeled a dick. I may be called a dick for speaking the truth, but some of the real dicks are the atheists who tell me not to be one. Some verbally attack me with a holier-than-thou attitude usually reserved for the most pompous of preachers, laced with bile and vulgarity reminiscent of the crap we get from the religious right. They don't wonder about whether there is room for breadth in the movement or even if there would be a movement without dicks like me. They see their way as the only way from which any deviation warrants an in-your-face confrontation with allies, all to protect the wrong people from hearing something true. They are abrasive to us, their brothers and sisters in arms, because we are slightly different from them. I'm not saying all nice guy atheists are assholes, just those who are so short-sighted they can't see how quickly and by how much this movement would lose its steam without firebrands to blaze the way for discussion by breaking the barriers of political correctness. Not calling bullshit on bullshit is bullshit. Allow me to illustrate my point about the need for breadth with a brief detour to the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Boston has a strong and thriving atheist community, led in part by Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard. As a popular, friendly leader in a city with a large population and high tolerance of the non-religious, Greg was perfectly positioned as a nice guy atheist to get support and inclusion from the religious community. And then the Boston Marathon bombing occurred. Suddenly, President Obama is heading to Boston for an interfaith vigil with local faith leaders. Greg, along with other secular representatives, knew and contacted the right people about getting involved. But they turned him and us away from the vigil. We represent nearly 40% of the Boston community, but were excluded from a community-wide mourning event, just as we were after the Newtown Massacre and from every single 9/11 memorial, because of bigotry. The nice guy approach didn't work. I have two problems with accommodationism, one of which, as I already explained, is the legitimization of religion in the eyes of the theists, the pedestal on which religion sits, and the bigotry that the pedestal enables. The other issue is that accommodationism addresses the wrong target, individuals. Diplomats envision changing religion from within, de-demonizing atheists in the eyes of one atheist at a time, the method of catching more flies with honey, not vinegar. This is analogous to how the churches have changed over history. Society evolves sufficiently beyond the church's teachings until the church is forced to change to keep parishioners, which it does to the smallest degree possible to avoid looking as if it's admitting it's wrong. For example, the recent changes in the Vatican and major churches toward the LGBTQ and atheist communities are a direct result of activism on those issues pulling society toward tolerance and society dragging religion along with it. The broad secular community is partly responsible for the pressure that is modernizing the Vatican. This kind of change happens slowly, in baby steps, because religion loathes change, which disproves its claim to objective truth based on infallible texts. Diplomats seek to emulate this evolution by changing the minds of believers, not about God, but about atheists, usually using more theist-approved euphemisms such as unbelievers or humanists, thereby forcing religion to become more pluralistic. It's easy and pleasant, and it seems polite. What many accommodating atheists don't understand is that all religions have one thing in common. They are all anti-atheist. We are the last outgroup on which all religions can agree. If they support equal treatment for atheists, they in effect advocate stepping off their pedestals. If atheism is equal to religions, religions have no advantages or pedestals over anyone at all. And so our equality endangers their legitimacy. So yes, representatives of religion can smile at us and shake our hands, but religions will not back us, help us, or support us when it counts. To do so threatens their existence. Diplomacy alone cannot trump greed, money, and power. That's why diplomacy alone will always ultimately fail to produce the results all atheists seek in a timely manner. That's why diplomacy alone failed in Boston. Enter the firebrands. We chip away at privilege, disrespect the unrespectable, and refuse to obey someone else's religious rules. We laugh at threats of hell, literally and loudly, while demanding total equality. We attract everyone's attention to atheists' existence and issues. Firebrands are the movement's awareness generator. Firebrands go on TV complaining and shouting and demanding, and then the diplomats come out to soften our statements, sometimes emphatically so. In the end, the firebrands look like the bad atheists, and the diplomats look like the good atheists, and guess what that means to believers? Good atheists do exist. This is called shifting the Overton window, a new name for an old strategy, and it is well described by Josh Polotsky at beautifultrouble.org as follows. Quote, "The Overton window designates the range of points on the spectrum that are considered part of a sensible conversation within public opinion and or traditional mass media. The most important thing about the Overton window, however, is that it can be shifted to the left or the right, with the once merely acceptable becoming popular or even imminent policy, and formerly unthinkable positions becoming the open position of a partisan base. The challenge for activists and advocates is to move the window in the direction of their preferred outcomes, so their desired outcome moves closer and closer to common sense. There are two ways to do this, the long, hard way and the short, easy way. The The long, hard way is to continue making your actual case persistently and persuasively until your position becomes more politically mainstream, whether it be due to the strength of your rhetoric or a long-term shift in societal values. By contrast, the short, easy way is to amplify and echo the voices of those who take a position a few notches more radical than what you really want. End quote. I wonder what would have happened if a few hundred firebrand atheists had protested our exclusion from the Boston Marathon Memorial Service. Would it have brought more attention to our cause? Would it have gotten us included? I cannot say for sure. I just know that the nice guy approach fell short, again, and nobody heard from the atheists, cared about our inclusion, or considered us part of the severely injured Boston community. Because of the firebrands, change is happening, and not on an individual level, but on a national level. Our lawsuits force a change in religion from without, humbling it by demanding enforcement of legal equality, while our honesty chips away at the pedestal on which theists place their religion. It's the firebrand who primes the theist for the diplomat. I wonder if the Obama administration and the Boston area clergy would have seen the Harvard humanists in a different light if American atheists had been the bad guys in Boston. Criticism against what we do focuses only on the idea of respect, not on the truth. This only plays into the hands of the people who run religion. Religionists want religion's placement on the pedestal of respect preserved by any means. But religion deserves no respect. Rather, it has earned scorn, ridicule, and in-your-face opposition, as have its trappings. Exhibiting disrespect toward religion in public chips away at its hold on the listening population. Men wearing funny hats, with rare exception, it's always men, need to be addressed by their first name because calling them Father or Your Eminence places them undeservedly on a higher tier than everyone else. A privilege that should be reserved for people who actually accomplish something noteworthy or worthwhile and deserve the titles they've earned, e.g. doctor, general, or governor. I find it disturbing that religious folks are always suggesting or even demanding that we be respectful of religion. Even if we disagree, we are told we must be nice and respect religion's place as equal or superior to the secular, rational position. But giving reverence to religion gives it strength and protects it from the criticism it deserves. Would you say it was okay for a major corporate executive to shuffle around pedophile employees and withhold information about them from the police? How about if the executives got caught and, instead of admitting guilt, chided the victims for making their abuse public? Yet worldwide, this is what we do for religions because firebrands are too few and far between, and everyone is giving reverence to religion because religion demands it. As a result, religion gets a bye on heinous crime after heinous crime, and its only defense is that religion gets to do what it wants because its God says so. The fictional executive of this paragraph would get life in prison, hated by all. The real Pope Benedict retired in luxury and honor. Remember, placing someone on a pedestal means the person is constantly looking down on you. I think religion deserves to look up to atheism. If anyone deserves a pedestal, it is those who revere and live by logic and reason. Recently, a priest against whom I was debating asserted I should call him Father. What a repugnant idea. My father is dead, and he hated religion to boot. Dad called preachers and rabbis whores. No priest comes close to deserving the same title as the man who helped rear me. This priest then asked if I would use his professional title, Reverend, which I said was a reasonable request, if he did the same for me and used my title, President. He didn't like that, oh no. He wanted to call me Mr. Silverman, using the standard honorific, while I used his professional title and called him Reverend. I gave him the choice. Each uses a standard honorific, Mr., to address each other, or we use the professional titles, Reverend and President, or first names, which I preferred, because we are equals. He got angry and walked away. When you put preachers on your level, they get offended. They resist being treated as equals because they aren't accustomed to it. Well, too bad. We get that a lot. So much of what we do is demanding equality and then being attacked because religions, mostly Christianity in America, don't want equality. They want, no, demand favoritism because they are used to it. They call equality offensive. If I called you ugly, you'd be legitimately offended. Any personal insult directed at you, an individual, would be reasonable cause for taking offense. Insulting religion is not offensive, at least not in the same way. Religion is not a person and has no opinions or feelings, but the masses assign a personification, a god, to their religion and then decide if your words or statements offend this fictional character. Just as gods can endorse candidates, so too can gods be offended if you insult their mythology. The followers simply feel insulted on behalf of their god, assuming they know their god well enough to decide what he, she, it would or would not find offensive. Let's say you thought I'd insulted your friend. You'd feel angry that your friend was insulted and would therefore be offended by proxy, unless your friend said, "No, wait, it's okay, I'm not offended for X reason," in which case you would feel better. Insulting a god is different because all of the decision-making occurs in the mind of the believers. They hear something, then decide whether their god is offended and become offended or angry on behalf of that god. Since none of the gods seem to be capable of telling believers, "It's okay, I'm not offended," gods only tell believers they are right, people often take action to defend their god's honor in accordance with their individual opinions of what their god might want. Just as some pick and choose their morals and life lessons from their particular holy book, so too do they cherry-pick that which offends their god. You might be thinking, shouldn't we do the very best not to offend them? Let's examine that logic. In American Atheist advertising and public statements, the objective is to further the cause of atheism, get more atheists out of the closet, and increase knowledge about and tolerance for atheists. That's it, by the way. Nothing in American Atheist charter seeks to force religious TV shows off the air or force all mention of religion out of the lives of Americans who believe, although that's what we are regularly accused of. For instance, though she's been dead for nearly two decades, Madeleine Murray O'Hare is still being accused of trying to take off the air all shows that mention God. The most famous victim was Touched by an Angel, which she successfully ripped from the airwaves after nine successful seasons, just a few years after she died. All of this stems from a rumor that she once started a petition to remove all mention of God from the airwaves, which never happened, as explained by Truth or Fiction, quote, "No such petition has ever been presented to the FCC by Madeleine Murray O'Hare or her Organization of American Atheists. In fact, this e-rumor is more than 20 years old and has produced more mail response to the FCC than anything in its history," end quote. I wonder what Madeleine's ghost will do next. Our mission is not to stop private citizens or TV or radio stations from using or promoting religion. Tons of religious shows, songs, and stations are out there, and they are all legal, unless they appear on a government-run channel. Perform a Google search, look up all the accusations against us for doing such things, and look for proof. We seek to bring atheism into the realm of the regular because it is regular. We seek to make people think, convert closeted atheists into outed atheists, and increase acceptance of atheists by theists. We seek the total and absolute separation of religion and government because that's how you achieve religious freedom for everyone. Some fervent believers are not going to convert no matter what we do, but they can become more tolerant. The past few years are full of stories about benign atheist billboards panned or banned by believers. The United Coalition of Reason's Good Without God 2009 and the Freethought Action Project's One Nation Indivisible 2010 billboard campaigns were nice and completely inoffensive, but they were hated by Christian believers and defaced. These people weren't placated by the positive contents of the billboards. They didn't care what they said, only that they existed. Their God, they determined, was insulted at the presence of any expression that atheists are extant, let alone relevant, and they complained loudly and emphatically. This is analogous to how atheists all face bigotry in our lives, not because we are hateful or rude, but because we are atheists. Have you ever lost friends because they found out you were an atheist? Did you have to offend them first? Not likely. Your experiences have probably mirrored mine. Someone finds out I'm an atheist, and then suddenly that person is no longer my friend. This has happened only a few times, fortunately, and to my surprise, it didn't bother me at all because I knew I was better off without these so-called friends. That's theists being rude. That's theists being bigoted assholes as a result of serious brainwashing by a poisonous religion cycle. They're not going to change their minds because of what we say or do. They want silence from us, and anything else will be taken as an attack on their God. So why should we be nice in our advertisements or speeches? Why are we pussyfooting around the truth to placate those who will only be truly placated by our silence? Why not concentrate on the segments of our market that might actually bring out the evolution we seek? We don't need to worry about offending those who are offended because we have the gall to exist, or those who will lie about us to make us seem less reasonable. We need to shout from the rooftops that which we know is true. Religion is a lie. Yes, all of it. Gods are myths. Yes, all of them. And most people already know it. Yes, they do. This is why, as president of American Atheists, I've taken a hard line with the organization's advertising policy. Other organizations can put up smiling faces and appeals to religious folks to like us. It's part of the movement's overall strategy, but it won't work alone, and it doesn't work for me. We need not beg for affirmation from those with unrespectable positions. Rather, we, who know the difference between fantasy and reality, need to claim that position proudly. We who are right need to say that we are right, so doubters can explore their doubts, knowing there is a place to land when they come to a conclusion. We have the responsibility to make fair and verifiable information available to them to perform their exploration. Yes, we need to reach out to the doubters, even if the theists hate us for it. Yes, we need to use the press to the best of our ability, even if that press is Fox News. Now, many atheists believe the best way to promote these ideas we all share is by leading with an outstretched arm, extending olive branch after olive branch, hoping that the nice guy approach will get us to equality. But frankly, I tend to doubt that will work because it never has in the past. Remember, our adversaries are not the believers. Our opponents are the string pullers, the professional liars and victims who wear robes and pronounce themselves holy, and the politicians in their pockets. Being nice may change the perception of atheists to some followers, but true believers follow their leaders, and their leaders aren't likely to walk away from power and money just to be nice. We are their last great bad guy. Accepting atheists dooms religion to the equality preachers fear so much. Now, to be sure, some friendly theists out there won't like their religion being called a myth, or their belief being called silly or backward. This does not detract from its being true. These nice, well-meaning people pray to an imaginary deity because they are victims of the religion that promotes it. They don't just think differently. They are incorrect, and they stick to their guns despite evidence to the contrary. It's not a respectable opinion. Yet they, the moderate, friendly theists, demand respect for it and get offended when it's not granted. But again, religion is on a pedestal because we allow it to be. And my answer to their demands for respect for their religion is no. Smart people can and do believe stupid things. That's what brainwashing is for. And it's important to internalize this fact. So many times I've heard atheists call religious people stupid, but these people aren't stupid, they're injured. They are force-fed from their earliest memories the idea that they are Christians or Jews or Muslims. They had no choice. The religion was drilled into them as part of their core identity. As a result, even when you correctly criticize the religion, they will take it as if you've attacked them personally. This is where I step in and make sure that I am being clear in my criticism of the religion, as I respect the human who, like the vast majority of the world's population, believes what the person's parents and religious leaders said about the man in the sky. We must remember our targets. Change is not going to come from the theist, but rather from the atheist. Being nice might make us more likable to small numbers of individual theists, but in the end, theists take cues from the preachers, who make money and earn a living by tearing atheism down. We need to concentrate on the atheists coming out and taking their rightful place in society, and this is done by motivating them to make the change. This is done with frank, honest talk without regard to political correctness, combined with compassion for the individuals afflicted with theism. All religion is cafeteria religion. If a man has sexual relations with a man, as one does with a woman, both of them have done what is detestable. They are to be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads. Leviticus 20:13. Orthodox believers often criticize less strict members of their faith for practicing cafeteria, insert name of religion here, meaning they aren't observing every chapter and verse of the faith and are therefore not as good a Christian, Jew, or what have you, as those who do. Here's the truth. Every religionist is a cafeteria religionist. Every time Christians and Jews meet an atheist and don't kill the person, they are committing cafeterianism. Every time a woman teaches a class, every time a man holds an old-fashioned football, every time anyone wears a blended fabric, the person ignores and breaks a biblical law. Why? Because these laws are stupid. That's really it, isn't it? Nobody worries about the biblical laws we all, as a society, collectively dismiss out of hand because they're stupid, outdated, or just plain inconvenient. Not only are these laws imperfect, they are not even worthy of a second thought, yet these laws stem from the supposed perfect word of God, or so the Bibles are marketed. I'm reminded of the man on the internet who tattooed Leviticus 20:13 on his arm in a clear statement against LGBTQ equality, while he totally ignored that just a few paragraphs away in the same context is a commandment against tattoos. This a la carte approach is especially apparent among the mainstream religionists. A 2003 Washington Post poll found that 88% of Catholics believed using a birth control pill or condoms was morally acceptable, which is the exact opposite of what Catholicism preaches. It's all subjective. Since it's all subjective, it's all up to the individual, as influenced to some degree by the person's religion cycle. On the granular level, that means all religionists are unique in their beliefs. So while some claim Christians are a majority, the truth is that when it comes to specific beliefs, everyone is in the minority because everyone is making conclusions about their God and morality individually. Please let that soak in. This means all good and bad morality is the result of your unique combination of genetic tendencies interacting with your moral upbringing, including your personal religion cycle, if any. As I've mentioned, religious people might think they are, for example, Christians, but in fact, religion is only a part of who they are. To varying degrees, the meme of religion invades our natural selves and imprints itself on our personalities, affecting people differently depending on all the other factors that make us us. Religion doesn't make people, but it changes them and shapes their morality, sometimes convincing otherwise nice people to make immoral judgments, essentially making nice people act like assholes. Holy books are broadly interpretable, with many examples of good and bad morality presented in a positive manner as approved by God. Those passages people dismiss as immoral are judgment calls they all make individually, irrespective of whether God says it's moral. In other words, terrorism is just as much a part of Islam as brotherhood. Killing gays and blasphemers is just as much a part of Christianity as loving thy neighbor. It's all individual. People make their own determination, pick out the parts of their holy scriptures with which they agree, and call their morality objective and perfect, whether it supports flying planes into buildings or helping a stranger in distress. The stuff in religion that you hate has no less of a basis in the source material than the stuff in religion that you love. Morality is fluid. What was once moral is immoral today, which includes rape, slavery, and infanticide. We simply cannot rely on the texts that promote such horrible ideals as sources for morality, because deciding whether a particular passage is moral or not is subject to the whim of the reader. Again, religion hates to admit it's wrong because it insists its tenets are divine, and therefore perfect. But morality is fluid and ever-evolving as we as a species learn and grow. As a result, religion will continue to espouse yesterday's values long after society has moved away from them. This can be seen today when preachers preach against LGBTQ equality or even women's equality. Because of its resistance to change, which is the result of its reliance on a supposedly divine and therefore perfect source, religion will constantly espouse things that are immoral by today's standards. This cannot change because religion cannot admit it's wrong without sacrificing its perceived moral perfection as a result of divine intervention / inspiration / dictation. Ironically, the moral pedestal on which religion places itself keeps religion immoral. By its very nature, religion will remain defined by yesteryear's morality always and forever. Thus, there will always be sects of religion that are immoral to the modern mind. Invariably, modern religionists will accuse radicals of not really being a member of that religion. They defend their religion by not admitting it is so broad as to support bad behavior, so they try hard to disassociate their religion from the people who, in the name of that same religion, do bad things. For example, Bill O'Reilly argued that Anders Breivik, who murdered scores of people, including children, in a 2011 Norway attack, was not a real Christian, even though Breivik stated outright that he did what he had done in the name of God, calling himself the savior of Christianity. Who was right? Both O'Reilly and Breivik supported their arguments with the same Bible, so how do we know who is correct? Similarly, many Muslims decry the acts of terrorism committed in the name of their God, saying that the terrorists aren't following Islam at all and are perverting the Quran. But as you would expect, supporters of the Taliban have some very different opinions on what makes a true Muslim. Both sides use their holy book to defend their positions. So who is right? Religious moderates are also doing what American atheists is doing, but in the wrong direction. They are normalizing the extremists of religion by increasing their religion's perceived penetration into American society while protecting that same religion from criticism when people do bad things in its name. They are making religion look better than it is by openly giving credit for their goodness to their religion while downplaying, ignoring, or actively denying the religion's immoral teachings. This is obviously the result of the indoctrination they received that taught them propping up their religion is a good thing, even when they know religion is flawed or wrong. If religion includes everything from heroism to genocide, and a believer picks which parts to observe, where is its utility? If it gives no more guidance than real life, where are the lessons, and why would its instructions be more relevant than any other teachings, especially those based on today's morality, knowledge, and society? Isn't real life the actual teacher here? If involvement strengthens religion, aren't all adherents, and atheists claiming to be adherents, really strengthening yesteryear's morality, modern immorality? People need to realize that all the God-supported immorality in holy books is simply a relic of yesteryear's morality that serves as indisputable evidence that religion is never perfect, objective, or even remotely dependable as a source of moral guidance. Good religious people are not good because of the moral teachings in their holy books. They are good despite the immoral teachings. That is, their genetics and other factors, which would make them good people, outweigh their indoctrination. By the same token, bad religious people are bad despite the good teachings in their holy books. Both are victims of the indoctrination they've received as part of their religion cycle. It's all picking and choosing from the religious cafeteria. It's all individual. It's all relative. I'll pray for you. Prayer is useful to everyone except the person praying. It's used to reinforce submission and reassert the power of religion over the life of the believer. If the preacher can get people on their knees begging for something, and the preacher controls what those people think about the God to whom they are praying, that preacher has a lot of power. And if the believer has a lot of power in the real world, well, that's why I cringe when I see any world leader paying pious homage to a religious leader. Who's in charge then? Prayer is also used by believers to pretend they are doing something good. If they are powerless to do anything tangible, they beg their God to bend his will to theirs, then stand up feeling as if they've helped in some way. The old atheist axiom, "Two hands that help are better than 1,000 lips that pray," comes to mind. Most often I hear the standard, "I'll pray for you," by some believer, usually Christian, who thinks that this is an escape mechanism, a witty closing line to give just before leaving the scene, a religious version of, "Yeah, whatever." To be clear, I'm not talking about those instances when theists know they can't help you with a particular problem or bad situation, so they tell you they're praying for you in an attempt to show support. I don't mind this, because they are doing something they think will help by praying for my health or well-being. It's useless. And if they know I'm an atheist, insensitive, but not malevolent. What I'm talking about is the "I'll pray for you" I get while debating or discussing religion, said by someone hoping for divine intervention to help me see the light, usually served with an extra helping of smugness. Some atheists respond with something witty like, "I'll think for you," but given the opportunity, I would rather educate than insult, and this situation is an opportunity. The better way is to inform the people that they are acting in a hostile manner. The believers who say they are praying for me are victims of a lie and they think they are doing something good. I let them know they are not. I tell them to imagine that I had a newfangled gun that forcibly turned religious people into atheists. I tell them the gun didn't really work, but I thought it did. Let's say I decided to force them to be atheists, so I pointed the atheist gun at them and pulled the trigger. Would they think that was a nice thing to do? Would they appreciate my effort? Or would they feel assaulted? When you pray for me, you are asking your God to change me. You are asking your God to forcibly enter my life and my brain and change my way of thinking. Using euphemisms such as asking God to open my heart to Jesus is evidence of the intent of the assault. Like my fictional gun, the prayer won't work, but the believers think it will and deploy a weapon that they believe I cannot defeat, a God, to make me just like them. It's not a nice thing to do, and it's not a minor thing to do. Rather, it is religious intolerance incarnate and demonstrates religion's unwillingness to peacefully coexist. Don't pray for me, I tell them. Accept me as I am instead. That usually gets the message across. On proofs. Possibly the lamest excuse to believe in God is Pascal's wager. Even I dreamed about God is better than this pale attempt to justify belief. Pascal posited that your belief should be measured on the downsides of the alternatives. Since the downside of being an atheist is bad, hell for eternity, if you're wrong, and the downside of being a wrong Christian, you just die, is not as bad, you should be a Christian. So pick the side with the worst downside for not believing and follow that just in case it's right, and for no other reason. Many have written of the flaws of Pascal's wager. God can read minds and knows you're just hedging your bets, for one. So I won't go into them here except to say that people who use this argument are simply not thinking. They are thinking with their heart, not with their head, which is another way of saying pretending to think, but actually not thinking at all. I'm reminded of a time when Richard Dawkins appeared on the O'Reilly Factor and backed Bill O'Reilly into a corner with the following simple observation. Dawkins: but you know that if you'd been born to another religion, if you'd been born to a Muslim family, you'd be a Muslim with every bit as much fervency as you are a Christian now. Bill O'Reilly: yes, but I choose to believe that my religion is correct. This is totally bogus. Belief is involuntary. You can't choose to believe something you really don't. You can choose tuna for lunch, but if I held a gun to your head, you could not choose to believe the world is flat. You believe the world is essentially round, and nothing can change that but a substantial amount of evidence to the contrary. Therefore, you cannot choose to believe. You can only choose to pretend to believe in God. You believe what you believe without regard to the ramifications thereof, and when people use the euphemisms of choosing to believe or thinking with my heart, what they are actually saying is that they don't believe at all but are faking it and don't want to admit it. This usually stems from the societal and familial pressures to conform to the religion in which they were raised. True believers do not choose to believe in their God. They just believe. But many self-proclaimed true believers may be choosing to pretend they believe what they are saying for all sorts of reasons, none of which are, "It makes sense to me." As Yoda might say, "Believe or believe not, there is no choose." The interest I have in believing a thing is not a proof of the existence of that thing. Voltaire. But this brings me to the worst part of Christianity, the punishment for thought. Their Bible says thoughts are enough to send a person to hell even though they are involuntary, e.g. Mark 16. What kind of God would do that? It's like punishing you for other involuntary things such as breathing or having a wet dream. True belief cannot be controlled. You can pray, dance, sing, and prostrate yourself, but none of that can allow you to control your knowledge-based doubts. These doubts are often begun and fostered by other people, and the church does not want you to doubt. So the church added in one more major sin that is always going to lead to hell. Again, not murder, not rape, not theft. No, the one big bad that trumps all these crimes is the victimless act of blasphemy. Blasphemy is an immediate go-to-hell penalty. It says in Matthew 12:31, "Blasphemy against the Holy Spirit shall not be forgiven. Deny the ghost and you're toast." This means if someone says something to you that sounds blasphemous, you'd better not agree, even in your mind, even a little. And again, since hearing the words might cause a lack of faith, you'd better avoid anyone who blasphemes. This is how cults work around the globe. Segregation and brainwashing, all to keep the believers away from the forbidden zone of religion. Doubt. This is how you make a flock of terrorized, obedient sheep. And in Christianity, for the crime of not believing, you are punished forever in the lake of fire. In Mark 16:16, Jesus says, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved, he that believes not shall be damned." Can't get much clearer than that. If it doesn't make sense to you as a Christian that babies should go to hell for not having been baptized, something the baby had no control or say over, you're going to hell. If it doesn't make sense that Eve was conned, or that God could have just forgiven people without the whole murder my son the Savior exercise, you will spend eternity in hell, burning forever, while the true believers rejoice above you in heaven. And so, Christians fear. They fear because parts of the Bible make no sense at all, no matter how hard you pretend. They fear because they are brainwashed from childhood into thinking they are sinners who will go to hell for these involuntary thoughts, and their only way to salvation is confession, obedience, and the self-loathing practice known as prayer, which again is just begging. They fear because God will send them to hell for something they cannot control any more than a baby can control being baptized. And here it is, the reason the New Testament is not only evil, but also evil genius. Christianity feeds off the fact that thoughts can be involuntary. In Matthew, Jesus says, "If you lust after a woman, you've committed adultery against your wife." Time to go to church and beg forgiveness for this involuntary and victimless crime. If you think God is a bit less about love and more of a tyrant, go to church or go to hell. It may occur to you that in Mark 13:30, Jesus said, quote, "I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened," end quote, referring to the second coming. This time has long passed, yet for 2,000 years, Christians have been saying the second coming is coming any day now. If you even think it may all be a lie, you have sinned by thinking too much, and you need to, say it with me, repent and go to church. And what does the church tell you? Obey the church, work hard, donate, and avoid outsiders and doubters. Remember, thought is not linear. You can have doubts and still fear the consequences of doubt, especially if you're raised that way. It's another part of being human. You can be taught to fear what you don't think exists, which is why people fear the dark, the boogeyman, and yes, gods. And the religious but doubting Christians fear God, so they comply. And the church grows and the churchgoers defend it because if you don't, the church won't help you navigate the haunting knowledge in the back of your mind that God is exactly like every other myth you dismiss. And if you don't lose that knowledge, if you don't suppress it completely and utterly, you risk eternity in hell, where nobody will ever save you. It's up to God to decide if your thoughts are pure enough, and you won't find out if they were until after you die. Eternity in hell for involuntary thoughts, and you go through your entire life wondering if you've had too many such thoughts to be admitted into heaven. This is not love. This is terrorism. All true believers in Christianity are afraid. They are all hoping, with every bit of hope they have, that the all-powerful mind reader will decide that they have enough faith to get into heaven. Any degree of doubt equates to a degree of fear, unless their doubt is so severe that they finally realize there is nothing real to fear. Those who doubt wish their belief were stronger and often try to make themselves believe more to convince themselves their own skepticism is wrong. This can be very frustrating because the facts are 100% on our side. Their religion is the most important thing in their lives, or at least it's supposed to be. More important than love, family, or even their own children, religion needs to be number one. Whether you are good is not as important as whether you are overtly faithful. Faithfulness gets you into heaven. but being obedient, productive, and generous makes you a good Christian. When you add faithfulness, obedience, productivity, charity, and poverty mixed together with a whole bunch of fear that can only be alleviated by the church, guess who benefits from that combo platter? God? No. You? Certainly not. Conveniently, the church gives you someone to obey who will tell you to be generous and give your money, which you earn through your productivity, to a charity like that very church. You're welcome. Here's the collection plate. You can taste the scam. To take it one level deeper, parents are told that they are bad Christians if they don't brainwash their children in the same church, inflicting the same cycle of doubt and fear on their kids. Parents of atheists are, to a degree, failed Christians. So parents inflict religion on their kids to be good Christians without realizing it's the exact opposite of what a good parent would do. Religion has once again convinced good people, parents, to do bad things, inflict religion on children, in the name of good, while actually just benefiting the church. Our ancestors were wrong. Our parents were wrong. We do them no service by pretending they were right. We are under no obligation to pretend to believe the lies our parents believed, but we are certainly under an obligation to tell our children the truth. There is an easier answer to Pascal's wager, however, since Pascal posited following the religion with the worst penalty for not believing. I feel dirty just saying that. Simply create a religion that has a worse penalty than Christianity's hell and apply. So, I propose a new religion, Silvermanity. If you don't do exactly as I command, you will spend eternity in super worse hell, and all your ancestors in heaven will also go to super worse hell, as will all of your descendants. That's worse than plain old Christian hell. And there is precedent. Just as Adam's sin washes over all his descendants, so will your sin of not following Silvermanity retroactively and in the future wash over your entire bloodline. Your parents, your children, all will pay for your sin against me for all eternity in an ocean of fire, much bigger than that tiny lake of fire in regular hell. There, a worse penalty. Believe it, or face the horrible guilt and consequences. If you believe in Silvermanity and it's wrong, you lose nothing, except the money you give me and the control over your life you yield to me, which is nothing compared to the bliss of super awesome heaven where all good Silvermanites go after they die. But if you disbelieve and it's right, the penalty is far worse than not believing in Christianity. So use Pascal's wager and follow my new religion, because even if I say right here that I just made it up, you can't prove it's not true with 100% certainty. After all, you don't know everything in the universe, and I might be just testing your faith. So you must give it relevance and respect it as you would any religion. I'm either right or wrong, so that's a 50-50 chance. So you'd better err on the side of caution, believe, or at least pretend to, and obey. Forever. See how easy it is to create a religion based on fear and to use double talk to make it sound reasonable? Try it yourself. It's fun and potentially ridiculously profitable. Just Google L. Ron Hubbard. For other proofs of the existence of God, numerous other books and online resources give excellent refutations of all of them. Without exception, none of the proofs hold water. But I want to take a moment to point out the same fraud in the most common proofs. Evidence suggests that Neanderthals invented the lie of God to explain the things that they didn't understand. Why does it rain? Why does the sun move? Where did we come from? I don't know, so it must have been God. God made the rain. God made the sun move. God made us. Of course, it was a very different God or gods from the ones over which we fight and die today, but they were based on the same concept. I don't know, therefore God did it. I can't imagine that the first argument for the existence of a god between those early Neanderthals didn't include this line of thinking. Then we found out how the rain was really made and why the sun traversed the sky, so the number of things we don't know, and therefore the number of things attributed to a god, shrank. God no longer made the rain, but we as a species didn't understand lots of other things, so God did all those things. Then we learned more and God did less. Now, the set of what we don't know is much smaller than it used to be, and so the number of things attributed to God has shrunk. This is called the shrinking God of the gaps argument because, as the gaps in our knowledge are reduced by scientific learning, the God who supposedly did all the stuff we still don't understand becomes smaller and less important. The arguments have not improved over time, but they have been disguised to cloud the issue. Many of today's popular scientific proofs of God are only the same Neanderthal-era thoughts dressed differently in an effort to make them look more logical or more based on reason. Following are some good examples. The teleological argument. What a great name. I love it when apologists think up complex names to hide the total scam they're peddling. Also known as the argument from design, and it goes like this. Quote, the name the teleological argument is derived from the Greek word telos, meaning end or purpose. When such arguments speak of the universe being ordered, they mean that it is ordered towards some end or purpose. The suggestion is that it is more plausible to suppose that the universe is so because it was created by an intelligent being in order to accomplish that purpose than it is to suppose that it is this way by chance. End quote. In other words, we start from the assumption that the universe is deliberately ordered and was made for a purpose and according to a design. Note that no specific design or purpose is posited, just that one must exist because it appears so to the observer, with no factual support given for this blatant assumption. Whose purpose is it? Nobody knows. Therefore, it must be my God. The argument presupposes a thing, asks who, not what, created the thing, and since there is no obvious rational answer currently available for this presumed thing, answers with, God did it, and calls itself science. Let's try another one. The cosmological argument, another great name, is an even more blatant ripoff of its Neanderthal roots. The cosmological argument is the argument that the existence of the world or universe is strong evidence for the existence of a God who created it. The existence of the universe, the argument claims, stands in need of explanation, and the only adequate explanation of its existence is that it was created by God. At least we can save a step this time. We don't have to invent a purpose or design about which to ask a question. We can just ask the exact same question about the universe itself that the Neanderthals asked about the rain. Where did it come from? Nobody knows, therefore God did it. Just like the Neanderthals' rain, God is the only adequate explanation. Because for some reason, we don't know is not an option. There, science. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The third copy of the same argument is the argument from morality. Quote, moral arguments take either the existence of morality or some specific feature of morality to imply the existence of God. End quote. I'm sure you can see where I'm going. This is analogous to the cosmological argument asking the same question about a different thing and getting the same answer. Where did the universe, slash design, slash morality, slash rain, come from? Nobody knows. Therefore, God did it. In my experience, these three arguments are the most commonly used, and they are the same argument that has been used since the Ice Age. There are no new proofs of gods. There are only new ways to dress up the old ones. The ridiculousness of these arguments becomes even clearer when you realize that they could be and have been used to prove other gods. I don't know, therefore God, is exactly the same as I don't know, therefore Zeus, or I don't know, therefore the flying spaghetti monster. How can a single proof prove multiple mutually exclusive solutions? They can't. The God of the gaps argument, no matter how it's dressed up, fails for this very reason. It's not proof at all. It just posits that what we don't know or understand must be supernatural because we don't know the answer, and claims credit for whatever God is espoused by the speaker. The fundamental argument is based on ignorance and bad skepticism. The dressed-up versions are cons. I think it's about time we stop thinking like Neanderthals. Quote, I'll tell you why religion's not a scam in my opinion, all right? The tide goes in, tide goes out. Never a miscommunication. You can't explain that. Bill O'Reilly. Of all the so-called proofs of a God's existence, none is given more unearned credit than the ontological argument. It's a clever word game used by preachers to convince doubters within their flocks that their God is real. Notice how I never said it was used for conversion, because I know of no one who was ever changed in any way by this migraine-inducing mess. While all of the thinkers in the atheist movement dismiss the argument as the game that it is, none that I've read have hit on the central point of why this argument doesn't work. Here's the argument in a nutshell. Imagine a most perfect being. Either this perfect being exists or he doesn't. However, existence is greater than non-existence, so a perfect being that does not exist would not be a most perfect being. A perfect being must therefore exist as a simple facet of being perfect. I know, I shouldn't have inflicted this on you. Feel free to pause this recording and go get some Motrin. I'll wait. Here's how I disprove the ontological argument. Imagine two identical people, person A and person B. They are exactly alike, except person A is an unrepentant axe murderer and person B is not. Given only that information, which person is more perfect? As a decent human, you obviously said B is more perfect than A because B doesn't kill people. This is because responsibility matters. People who kill must be judged by their action, and in almost every society on Earth, they are. This must be factored into the idea of perfection for this argument. Imagine now God A and God B. They are all-powerful, perfect, omniscient gods, and the only difference is that God A exists and God B does not. God A, then, is singularly responsible for all the suffering on Earth, ever. He is responsible for every hungry child, every hurricane, every disease, and every ounce of suffering endured by every living thing ever, because being omniscient and all-powerful, he could have prevented it all, but chose not to. The problem of evil. This is not canceled out by the good of our existence in the first place. Since God A could have created all of us without any pain or suffering, all-powerful means he can do anything, it must be assumed that he gave us suffering for some less than perfect reason. Creating a being that suffers its whole life is not a good thing. It's horrible, and it's far worse when you consider it's not necessary. It's an optional net negative, and the responsibility would sit squarely in the lap of the all-powerful deity who made it happen. God B, on the other hand, does not and never did exist. As such, he bears no responsibility for anything in the universe. Nobody can point to God B and accuse him of anything. He didn't do anything. Now imagine a perfect being. This perfect being either exists or not. However, a perfect being would not be responsible for all the death and suffering in the world, but a God that exists, assuming that he were all-powerful and omniscient, as this argument is positing, since that is part of perfection, would definitely be large and in charge and bear 100% of the responsibility. Therefore, a more perfect God would not exist, bearing no responsibility at all. The ontological argument fails because perfection is subjective. My perfect God includes responsibility for evil. Others may differ, but in either case, it's a subjective definition of an objective-sounding word. There's the trick. There can't be a most perfect being any more than there can be a most beautiful person. Perfection is in the eye of the debater, and in my opinion, any being that willfully causes all the pain and suffering on this planet for all living beings throughout history is far from perfect. Every proof of every god has something in common. None of them are actually proofs of any gods at all. They are all word games and logical fallacies. As I mentioned earlier, we as a species have a set of information we call facts. These are things we know. While we don't know everything, it would take real solid evidence to change our minds because we are extremely confident in what we know as opposed to what we suspect or think. For instance, we know people cannot fly based on all available evidence. We don't know everything, but we can state people can't fly with confidence because we know it. If you come to me and say you know someone who can fly, I'm not going to seriously consider the possibility that you're telling the truth unless you can prove it. If some flying person then swoops in and is proven to fly by scientists who perform a few tests to make sure it's not some kind of trickery, or if you find remains of people with wings or some other convincing evidence that proves the existence of flying people, I'm right there. I'll accept I was wrong. However, if instead you support your assertion with, "You don't know everything, you can't prove no human can fly," or, "I like to believe we can fly, the world would be much better if humans could fly," or, "How did this person get from point A to point B? You don't know, therefore he flew," I'll know you're insane, brainwashed, or have an agenda. So now let's look again at God's supposed attributes. God is immortal. He was never born. He has no parents. He is everywhere at the same time. He has power to create matter and energy with his will. He knows everything and can read minds. He can control people's thoughts if he wants to. That's far less believable than a flying person. All of these attributes break the known laws of physics and therefore go against what we know as a society. To posit a being with one of these attributes would require solid proof. But all of them? And this is just a short list. For anyone to propose a being that has so many impossible attributes exists, the person has to have real, positive proof for it, at least as much as we would demand for the far less implausible flying human. I don't need, "How else can you explain?" I need, "Here is scientifically valid support that an eternal being can exist, and here is scientifically valid support for a being that can create and destroy matter and energy," etc. If you're going to tell me that everything we've learned is wrong about anything, you're going to need to actively prove it with testable, peer-reviewed results. Anything less than proof is no proof at all. To date, 100% of the proof offered for any God's existence has been no proof at all. On the defense of the indefensible. Recently, I had a discussion with a minister's wife who proposed a Stockholm Syndrome-like defense of God's outrageously hateful behavior. God's seemingly immoral actions were moral, according to her, because God can do all the things he does. His ability to create hell and send billions of souls there for eternity made it moral for him to do so. Just as victims of Stockholm Syndrome defend their captors, so too did this believer defend what she admitted to be horrific behavior. She further opined that since God created us, he could do whatever he wanted to do to us, much like an owner would treat a slave, all under the aegis of morality. I could hear the religion destroying her brain right in front of me. If I had the power to create a human, knowing in advance that the person would be tortured forever, it would not give me the moral right to do so, and if I did, most would call me a monster. But God of the Bible does just that, and religion poisons brains into thinking that's okay. No matter the motivation, defending the indefensible in this matter is par for the course. Indeed, the entire business of religion hinges on its ability to dodge criticism. Quote, "One cannot insult other people's faith. One cannot make fun of faith. There is a limit. Every religion has its dignity. In freedom of expression, there are limits." End quote. Pope Francis, January 2015. Religion must be correct, and it must convince believers it is correct all the time. The problem is that religion is wrong so often and on so many levels that even basic knowledge can be inconvenient, to say the least. Let's take another look at Genesis 1, which reads as follows. Quote, "In the beginning God created heaven and earth, and the earth was waste and lifeless, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And God said, Let there be light. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening and there was morning, the first day." Science proves religion wrong all the time, and religion hates science as a result. Remember, science is just another term for learning as opposed to believing what preachers tell you. Since the advent of science, about 350 BC, apologists have been trained and recruited in an attempt to explain why science isn't actually proving religion, in this example Judaism and Christianity, wrong, but rather right. Genesis 1 is a perfect place to demonstrate their dishonest tactics. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In 1978, astronomers Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for their discovery of cosmic microwave background radiation, which provided important corroboration of the Big Bang theory of the universe's beginnings 13.8 billion years ago. However, Christian apologists simply read what they wanted and tacked it onto their religion. God said it, and bang, it happened. This shows a common theme. Apologists basically retrofit their holy text to mean something it didn't originally after science fills in a gap of knowledge. Hence, the Big Bang is just echoes of the great creation by God. One can see how easily the same argument can be applied to any god, including the flying spaghetti monster. But moreover, there is a huge difference between God created heaven and earth and what actually happened during the Big Bang, as explained for this book by Dr. Lawrence Krauss, author of A Universe from Nothing, which you should read. Quote, "Heaven and earth were created anything but together. Our earth is only 4.5 billion years old, whereas the observable universe is 13.8 billion years old. Literally, billions of stars have emerged and died before our own sun and earth arose from a dense gas cloud in the Milky Way. Indeed, there is nothing about Genesis that gets the Big Bang right, in order or detail, except for the trivial fact that both imply our universe had a beginning. Perhaps the most important difference is that our Earth resides in a random place at the outskirts of an average galaxy in the middle of nowhere. There is nothing special about its location or the time in which it arose. Moreover, over 95% of the universe is composed of something other than that which makes up our Earth. We are a bit of cosmic pollution in a sea of dark matter and dark energy." End quote. So herein lies one of the common tactics of apologists, taking their wrong information and calling it right. Science proves what the Bible clearly states, even when it doesn't. The problem is that believers, already desperate to hold on to their beliefs, will nod in frantic agreement when this lie is told because they want their Bible to be right, even when it's way off. "And there was evening and there was morning the first day." Here's a great place where we often hear, "Oh, that's a metaphor for billions of years." If I walked up to you and said, "There was an evening and a morning the first day," you'd probably assume I was talking about a day. You certainly wouldn't think I was talking about a billion years, yet that's what the old Earth creationists will tell you with a straight face. Remember, religion hates to admit its Bible is wrong. To admit it is wrong is to admit the words of its God are imperfect and therefore non-divine in origin. The alternative is to have an imperfect or deceitful divine author to whom nobody would pray. To admit it is human-made is to place it on the same level as all the other books written by humans, removing its pedestal. A Bible with errors written by humans? Why do we care again? Without perfection and objectivity, religion is totally unnecessary and preachers know it, so they forever push the lie of perfection to protect the lie of God. This is why religion will never admit its errors, but instead uses shtick like this, reminiscent of Monty Python's ex-parrot sketch, to deny all wrongness ever, regardless of facts. So when scientists proved beyond any reasonable doubt that the universe is billions of years old, these creationists lied to themselves and others that day no longer meant day, but actually ages. That wouldn't be so outrageous a claim if the word day wasn't modified by "and there was evening and there was morning," which kind of takes away all doubt that the writers were talking about days as we know them and not some magical day lasting a billion years. This is where you wonder how a perfect God could create a book that could be so misleading as to use the word day to mean a billion years. This is where you wonder how wrong that other stuff could be. This is where religion becomes the ex-parrot. "And God said, let there be light," after he created Earth. Again, wrong because carbon. To date, I have not heard the apologetic response to this proven incorrect statement from Genesis 1. Even the most religious scientists, the most brainwashed victims who can't get past their wall of indoctrination with their knowledge, will tell you carbon is a major element of this planet and all life thereon. They will also tell you that carbon was not formed in the Big Bang, but rather in the bellies of stars, all of which produce light at some point. Given everything we know, see, and can measure, the Earth did not precede the existence of light, as Genesis clearly states. It's not even a day equals ages thing. It's completely the opposite of what has been proven true. Pastors like to say God is the author of their Bibles. If that's true, then their God was wrong. Once again, with this kind of provably incorrect information in the Bible, one wonders how sane people could look at anything therein and be sure they are reading the truth. But again, brainwashing. Another place where denial of reality is rampant is in the creation and evolution debate. This is where it gets more fun. The evidence in support of evolution leaves no room for doubt. Any theist hearing this should, if he or she doubts, read any of the wonderful books on the subject, including Richard Dawkins' The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. Or just go to any natural history museum or fossil shop. There is so little doubt that the Vatican and even Pat Robertson have admitted evolution is true. But there's a problem with this admission. If you grant evolution, you acknowledge the Garden of Eden didn't happen. You acknowledge Adam and Eve both had parents, and those parents seemed every bit as human as did their children. You admit no man from dirt, no woman from a rib, no Garden of Eden, no talking snake, no original sin, no need for redemption or a savior. In this way, evolution disproves the entire basis for Christianity, as well as Judaism and Islam, but of course the theists can never admit it. Those who have chosen to embrace young earth creationism are never going to be respected because most high school kids can prove their ideas wrong. Those who embrace old earth creationism embrace one of their major weaknesses. Everything in Genesis is wrong, including original sin, so there is no need for a savior, so Jesus had no purpose and died for no reason. Without Adam and Eve, the core of Christianity falls away. Evolution is proven sure stuff, and it proves all creation myths, including the Old Testament, wrong. Religion hates to be proven wrong, so it will pull out all the stops to deny it, including dumbing down our science classes with mythology cloaked in the euphemism of intelligent design. This is done in an attempt to elevate myth to the level of science and to discredit that which we know is true in order to allow religion to avoid admitting it is wrong. That's why we have creation museums, where cavemen write dinosaurs and Noah's Ark is totally feasible, because theists want the public ignorant. It's dishonest, immoral, and directly hurts every child who is never taught how to determine fact from fantasy. It is one of the worst sides of religion. Some preachers attack the scientific method instead of addressing their own arguments, which is ridiculous, because in a nutshell, science is a form of learning. Let's say you were trying to solve a maze and you were at a point where you had three paths from which to choose. You choose path A. You hypothesize that path A is correct. You take that path, testing hypothesis A, and find a wall. So path A fails and is not the correct answer. Then you try path B, but it also fails because you hit another wall. Finally, you try path C and you succeed. So path, hypothesis, C is the answer. If you describe your efforts to your friends, some may try out the same puzzle, and if they take the same steps as you, they will get the same results. Peer review. Congratulations. You've used the scientific method to learn the answer, as we all do in everyday life. Trying on clothes, finding a new way to the store, eating a new food, is all learning via a form of the scientific method. It's all hypothesis, test, revise. It's how we learn. Then your friend, who is stubborn and refuses to admit they are wrong, insists path A is correct because it is what they were taught. You show them the path and the wall to which the path leads, but your friend insists you're still wrong. You argue, and your clearly wrong friend insists, despite being pummeled with undeniable evidence that they are wrong, that it's just best to say both A and C are equally possible. Path A is correct to them, and path C is correct to you. They then say, your method is an assault on their belief. Hating the scientific method is hating learning. Those who oppose learning via the scientific method seek not to find the answer, but to find a way to justify their incorrectness. Failing that, as they will every single time, they demonize science itself, choosing to label science anti-religion. which betrays a complete ignorance of a basic fact. Science is not atheistic by choice or practice. Science is only in line with atheism because science has never found any proof of God. If science ever finds proof of a God, it will immediately become the antithesis of atheism. Science is anti-religion in the same way it is anti-flat earth and anti-geocentrism. Those things are wrong. Should atheism ever be proven wrong, it will be proven so by science. I'm not holding my breath.